Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast, sponsored by SeeRadioDifferently.com. I'm Tim Burrows.
And I'm Robin Hicks.
This week,
Seven's big breaches on advertising McDonald's to kids.
The radio ratings are in, as Sydney says goodbye to Merrick at breakfast.
A new player enters the media group buying circle.
And Julia Gillard's comedy debut and the week in TV. So with us this week in the studios of CBS Interactive is TV and radio presenter now Jason Davis. I'm not sure whether to call you Jabba or Jason Davis these days. Which one actually are you these days?
Well, they are one and the same, Tim. In fact, as I move towards trying to, get away from Jabba, I found myself the other night creating a Facebook page for Jabba. So I don't do too much stuff as Jason Davis, but, you know, you and I have met as Jason, so... Yeah, you can call me either. Jason, Jabba.
I guess it's a sign of sort of your increasing maturity coming into the Mumbrella Cast on your birthday as well.
Exactly. I would call it a pre-middle-age crisis.
Well, let's... I was trying to work it out. I guess you've sort of been in broadcasting for sort of 15, 16 years now, something like that, starting with Channel V. What was your kind of break?
It was actually before Channel V, before it was taken over by a Murdoch brand. Pay TV in Australia was represented by a channel called Galaxy, which had 60. You know, they used to put out the magazines and it would say now with 8 channels. and that started off as a channel called Red, the music channel, and I just really fluked into that with a guy I'd worked with at a cafe. His flatmate worked at a casting agency and they were looking for someone, and I auditioned and they went, "That guy looks a bit zany. He's wearing a fluoro, you know, worker's vest and a flannelette shirt. He's got a shaved head. Give him a job."
So that would just be any Surrey Hills hipster.
Exactly right. So I just came in at the right time and was very lucky enough to have a producer in Paul Fenwick, who I still work with at SBS, and he just, you know, grilled me and drilled me, and we used to do 40 takes of really basic kind of auto cue reading things, and his key advice to me was, "Show me the dancing eyes."
What does that mean?
It doesn't really translate so well over podcasts.
It looked great.
That's why I've got a shorter radio career than my TV career.
Well, I was going to ask, I suppose one of the things about doing something like that with TV is it must be a really good way of building up a lot of experience, a lot of hours experience, without too many people watching your mistakes as well.
Look, it's exactly right, Tim. I think I've been really fortunate that a lot of people now have so much attention shone on them from a very early point in their careers, whereas I've been very fortunate to have thousands and thousands of hours of not too many people watching me fluff stuff, and I'm really grateful for that.
And then radio. Which do you actually prefer, radio or
TV? Definitely, yeah.
Well, why?
I guess because of that fact that you can communicate so much in a look. And I think part of it is an ego thing. You having done a lot more TV than radio, the people that work in radio seem to be much more pure about it, whereas the TV people seem to be quite snobby towards radio. They always say that TV is radio is TV without the pictures. So I find I'm better at TV than radio. I think I need a lot more practice in radio so that I can get my ideas across.
And you've given you've done several bits recently. One of the most recent was in Brisbane for Nova. How did you find that?
That was atrocious, actually. I come off the back of a very difficult time in my life, and I moved to Brisbane, and I was hired to be, you know, Jabba, to be zany and quick and, you know, cheeky and whatever, and I found myself the only thing I could do was go, "That's right, vote for your favourite song, 13, 24, 10. And that was it. And my poor colleague, this wonderful girl, Justine, she'd do the rest. "Hey, it's Jabba and Justine's countdown, and, you know, we're counting down for the east side." And she was all perky and talking about the songs, and I just go, "Yep, 13, 24, 10. That's still what we call, I can't think of the phrase, but it's that crutch, you know, that you have when you just go, "Nova."
Got nothing else to say.
Umbrella.
There's always a time check
exactly,
or something.
Exactly.
And you sort of mentioned the difficult time. This was sort of post Band in the Box.
Band in the Bubble, yeah,
Band
exactly
in the Bubble,
right.
Sorry,
exactly,
yes.
Right. So that was a well documented in my life kind of period, and it's kind of 7 years on from that, and there's still
is
you
that
know,
how long it is?
Yeah, September 2004. So
this was for those who don't know, and I count myself as someone who's been in the country about 5 years. This was a sort of promotion where the band made the album, stayed in the Perspex box with you,
yeah,
like being in the Big Brother house, but even
exactly
more intense, I guess.
Yeah, and the intense thing I found wasn't, I guess, so much being on camera because I loved that. It was people coming and banging on the glass at 4 a.m. going, "Do something." And it's like, we can't sleep, you know, it was sleep deprivation. And I think, you know, to be honest, the production team behind it were thrilled when there were those types of incidents because it made for more interesting viewing. If we were just sleeping all the time, then who cares?
It reminds me, actually, of I remember David Blaine did that thing in the box in London, and I remember going past in the middle of the night, and there were people throwing eggs at the box.
And what was he doing? Did he sleep through it?
He just... You couldn't really see... Because it was quite high up, and it was dark, so you couldn't really see what he was up to. But you know, it was, I think he did 30 days or something.
That was one of the key inspirations for the project.
Okay, yeah.
Wow.
Jason, how did they prepare you for that? Like, what kind of...
None, unfortunately. Yeah. I think it was a last-minute decision. Basically, digital TV was coming in around that time and they realised they could get bandwidth to broadcast 24/7. So it went from me being doing a half-hour show daily to being, you know, 24/7 for 3 weeks straight. So that was too much for me on top of, you know, kind of personal stuff that I was going through. So,
and was there a point where you thought... Sort of halfway through, actually.
I did get on September 11, you know, of course, an iconic date. We had someone break into the bubble and I freaked out and threatened them with violence. And I had a key to the back of the bubble and I got out and went and stayed the night in a nearby hotel and then made the decision to come back. And then after that, the locks were changed and I couldn't get out. So that kind of, saw a significant change in my mental state.
Yeah.
But made for good viewing.
Strange.
How did you get through it for that long, though? How did you keep going?
I took a lot of drugs, to be honest. So, you know, I don't take drugs anymore. But at the time, increasing, amounts of drugs. So by the time I got out, I was, well and truly fucked.
See, this must be the interesting thing, though, now, is I guess for those who are around then, a lot of perceptions are about your time then rather than where you're at as a presenter now.
Well, that was kind of the big thing. That was my bowing out. You know, I'd worked for the channel for 10 years and then that was the last big thing that I did for them. And at the time, I wasn't in the headspace to be able to appear on camera, so I kind of went, that's it. I wanted to sue the channel and all kinds of stuff. But, because of my drug use and whatever over many years, I had to take responsibility for my own actions as well and kind of let bygones be bygones. And I've gone back to work for the parent company. I've appeared on Channel V, on Max, on the Lifestyle channel. So it's, it's kind of bittersweet returning to it, to be honest. And, it was, for me, it was the end of an era. I've struggled to be the same Jabber, I suppose, since then.
I remember talking to, we did a video interview with Tim Ross after he'd finished as Merrick and Rosso. And he was sort of saying that for him, it was just this everyday getting up and chasing the 18 to 25 demo. And there's a point about at which you've changed, but all the perceptions haven't sort of caught up with you. Do you think that that's still the thing for you a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, I need to find the kind of next project that stamps my mark as something different than what I did for 10 years as Jabber. And, funnily enough, I recently did a show for National Geographic Channel, which was called Jabber's Curious World. And there was a different tone to that in the way I presented and, it wasn't zany, but it was still, I suppose my best element. So my big question is, should I still trade under that name, or does that name mean, like a can of Coke means fizzy sugary goodness? What does Jabber mean? Does it mean a 25 year old mentality when I'm actually 38? That can't be good.
How has that your experience in the bubble, in the box, influenced your view on reality television and contestants going on and letting their lives be watched, Big Brother, but then some other shows as well? Do you think they're nuts?
I think people need to have preparation about what they're going into. I think a lot of people walk into it blindly. I certainly didn't have the preparation that was necessary for me to grapple with, the conditions that I was under. So, the first day I ever filmed television back in 1995, I was telling Tim, I walked out and I thought everyone would go, there's that guy from TV. Of course, I hadn't even gone to air yet. people sign up for these things, chasing fame and money and notoriety and whatever. The key is really, and this is where I think movie stars get big paychecks, they're paying for the sacrifice of their privacy. I think That is the thing that I cherish the most, and that's why I've kind of been glad to fly under the radar working for SBS, working on pay TV, is that most people in the country wouldn't know who I am, as opposed to a couple of guys I've worked with, Andrew Ginsberg, James Matheson, who went on to host Australian Idol. Those guys can't go anywhere without people going, "You're that guy," and either getting a reaction or being stared at or a photo or whatever. That's intrusive.
You're right actually about that parallel thing of sort of pay TV. You go along to the Astro Awards and everyone's coming up the red carpet and it's like being a strange parallel world where you don't know who anybody is coming up the red carpet.
That's the guy from the gardening show. Yeah, absolutely. I was there recently going, I don't know anyone. And Sarah Murdoch got up and I was like, wow, that's a big name. But you look around the rest of the room and you go, Oh, that's the guy from Grand Designs. I like them.
And a good show, though, actually. I like Grand Designs Australia.
Love Grand Designs. They were big winners this year. And the other show, the one with Kevin
McLeod.
That's Grand Designs, isn't it? The other one where they sell the house.
Selling Houses Australia with Andrew Winter.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, I love him. I love that team. Charlie and the woman that's... her name escapes me. She's fantastic. Yeah, I really love that show. Yeah. And they were there, so I got a buzz out of sitting near them.
Now, you mentioned Paul Fenwick earlier. You've still been working with him. Now, it's possibly the most anticipated SBS program ever in Houses, thanks mainly to A Current Affair, I think. How did you get involved in that project?
As I mentioned before, Paul was my first producer in pay TV. He needed someone to play a junkie in an early episode of Fat Pizza and asked me if I'd be involved. I didn't think twice. And my role for Paul for many years was just turning up and smoking a bong on camera. So there's, you know, the ultimate in method acting, I suppose. And so I've had a relationship with him for a long time now. We've got kids around the same age, and he's been, you know, one of my biggest champions, really. He's always offered me work and fit me in where I could around radio commitments and whatnot. So Houses, I think, is my biggest role, working with Paul, playing a character called Dazza Smith, who is basically very similar to Dave O'Dinkum, the other characters that I've played. And I think it's the most Aussie thing that Paul's done, or the most Anglo thing. I think it speaks more widely to much more people than his previous efforts, which have been seen to be much more ethnic.
And that one suddenly got a lot of publicity because, I think it was A Current Affair. It might be in Today Tonight. One of them
both
got,
shows.
Right. Okay. Yeah. One of them got hold of the promo, didn't they? And I think initially thought that it was a documentary.
Exactly right. You know, who is this government-funded production taking pot shots at our, you know, the lowest members of society, or the most unfortunate members of society? And that was the angle that they kicked it off with and discovered very quickly, no, it's actually a comedy. And as soon as they started showing it to people in disadvantaged suburbs or, you know, poorer demographic suburbs, the people were like, this is awesome. I want to sit down with a can of rum and watch this.
And have you seen much of the finished product yet?
Yeah, we've had a screening. I think it's absolutely Paul's best work. You know, I think it's that adage, the Malcolm Gladwell thing of 10,000 hours. You know, Paul's made an enormous amount of material for the screen, both the big screen and the small screen, and he's getting better and better, and Houses is the funniest thing he's done.
And do you know yet when it goes to air?
Monday, October 24, 10 p.m. Soon. It's a late slot, which means we can get away with a lot more. And, I can't wait to see people's reaction to it.
Next, Seven breaches the rules for advertising to kids.
There's more to radio than music through your headphones. Radio can connect your brand with consumers in more ways than just over the airwaves. Check out the case study for Nissan Microcitizen, where listeners were sent to LA, Barcelona and New York to get in sync with the city. Or the interview on how the Lady Gaga deal for Vodafone all-time prepaid was done. See that and more at seeradiodifferently.com.
So it's been all about the kids this week, with the ongoing issue of advertising to children surfacing in two separate cases. The first was earlier in the week when the Cancer Council took aim at advertisers who used cartoon characters to promote their sugary and fatty foods. In another story, Channel 7 was found to have breached restrictions on advertising to children more than 70 times with a McDonald's promotion. So Tim, on the latter, on McDonald's and 7, where did they go wrong?
Yeah, so this ruling is ACMA, the Australian Communications and Media Authority. So they were acting on complaints that some promos that Seven were running, so not actual ads, but the promos, you know, where you see the Seven logo, sometimes I think they call them interstitials, featured footage from the McDonald's ad when they built this giant adults playground at Circular Quay in Sydney outside Customs House to film an ad. And then when this ad came out, it was all around that. So there were a couple of issues, one of which was this an ad or not? And ACMA decided that yes, it was, although it was, you know, a Seven network message, it was clearly an ad too. So it shouldn't have run during the times that kids are watching, because there are rules around what foods can be advertised to, you know, unhealthy foods being advertised to kids or arguably unhealthy foods. And secondly, was it a disguised ad that kids wouldn't realise an ad? So it was found to have breached both of those. And one of them, I think it was about 29 times and the other one 33 times. So, which doesn't add up to 70, does it? So perhaps it was 39 times and 33. My very weak maths
that
tells
still
me.
Still doesn't add up to 70.
Well, it was more than 70 in my in my defence. But anyway, what I thought was quite interesting as well was the comment from McDonald's. Really, they wanted nothing, no part of that, did they? They were very, very happy to put the blame on
Seven. How did they not know that this was going on? And Simon Francis from Seven put his hands up and said, look, you know, we did wrong. This shouldn't have gone on air. We're very sorry. We've learnt from it.
I think McDonald's argument was time of day.
Right.
So I suspect that there was enormous bollocking delivered to the media agencies, OMD, and they would have been the ones that negotiated it. What, of course, we don't know is whether OMD said very firmly to Seven, don't air it during the day. And I guess if you're not, you know, if you're not sitting in the agency with the TV on during the kids' programmes and you're not expecting to see it then, you may not catch it because if you only expect to see it in the evenings, you're only probably watching in the evenings. And that usually seems to be what happens when any of these brands fall foul of advertising to kids. It's usually make goods run during the day and, you know, the kind of the cock-up has happened.
But yeah, I guess what the consumer will be thinking on the man on the street will is, is this just a question of McDonald's getting away with it, or was it a genuine mistake? And what's your thoughts on, you know, whether it's Seven or McDonald's and how it was allowed to happen?
It was probably a cock-up, wasn't
right.
it? I mean, it was McDonald's are so paranoid about being seen to do the right thing, no way would they have given the instructions, you know, go and slip this in and see if you can get away with it. But at some point between where they briefed the media agency and when the media agency briefed Seven, it clearly kind of fell through. Or probably somebody just didn't even think about it. You know, they know that they can't run the ads, but these aren't ads, so, you know, the conversation isn't had. They probably just booked for a certain number of days that the branding looked like that and didn't think about it.
Yeah.
The thing is, these guys are so serious about it now. I mean, I remember judging, or being on a judging panel of awards in the UK where I was sitting next to somebody from a brand that does products for kids, and an entry came in regarding his brand that and he was the marketing director at the brand, but the media agency had entered, and they'd used the phrase, "We used Pestapower," which of course is a massive no. And he just kind of went pale and then took it and he got his phone out and went walking out the room. And he came back in about 2 minutes later looking very stern. I think the agency had just had an enormous bollocking. So,
Yes. Yeah. The other story, moving on to Kellogg's.
I just wanted to jump in there because reading up on that, it seemed to be the issue not so much the Macca's ads, but the inclusion of the Hamburglar and Grimace, that they were kind of, you know, characters in the thing. And I thought that was really interesting because does that mean that the McCafe in Sunrise, which is obviously watched during children's hours, that's okay? Because it doesn't have those kids' things?
Do you know what? That's a really interesting point, actually. Because, and of course, the thing was, Hamburglar and Grimace, in the kind of the big sort of 30-second ad that came from that, they didn't appear particularly prominently.
They just flashed through as a set of swings and a character in the corner. So, it seems to be...
Yeah, so that's a good point that does take it a bit more in the kids' direction. Maybe I'm being too generous and maybe I should be slightly more cynical. But you're right. I think on the defence on the Sunrise thing is because that's a programme which they could argue is aimed more at adults than kids, that in the same way like something like The X Factor, because you often see like complaints will come in. The X Factor is watched by loads of kids, but because it's not specifically a kids' programme, they get away with a bit more, which you often see the Ad Standards Board will do the same sort of rulings around that one as well. But actually, the kids' characters in it is a bit more significant, really.
Yeah,
isn't
on
it?
Kids' characters again. I think the ACMA ruling will have pleased the Cancer Council, which I mentioned before.
Oh, good link to
trying
the other story.
The Cancer Council want to ban cartoon characters from promoting sugary and fatty foods. So that would mean Coco the monkey on Coco Pops would go, and similar characters would vanish. So they're not saying they want to introduce plain packaging, as they're trying to do with cigarettes, but they think that cartoon characters are promoting sugary and fatty foods to kids. Now, Jason, you're a father. What do you make of that?
Look, I to be honest, I really feel for the Cancer Council on this because it seems to have drummed up a whole bunch of bad PR for them rather than achieve anything about limiting the amount of bad foods that we give our kids. You know, it's ultimately the parents that write the shopping list, drive to the supermarket, put the food in the trolley, pay for it, put it in the cupboard, pour it in a bowl and let it get into their kids' bodies. So, you know, a quick Google search on cereal packaging, you know, reveals that every character in the under the sun has been used to market cereal, you know, from owls to camels to bees to whatever. Like, it's I think to ban that is an extreme thing. Anyone that would give their give their kids Cocoa Pops every day is, you know, a pretty sick parent.
Yeah, and aren't they sort of insinuating that, you know, Cocoa Pops would give you cancer? I know it's a sort of tenuous link, but isn't that a sort of big jump that they're asking the consumer
to make?
It's
a big jump you've just made. Right.
Well, there's a lot of research now coming out that that sugar is bad. I mean, my understanding of sugar from my own you know, experience with other mind-altering substances is that it's basically heroin with the fun bits taken out. sugar, as well as opioids, which are heroin, codeine, morphine, etc., they trigger the beta endorphins in the brain. The effect of that is an analgesic, which dulls and numbs pain.
I think you've actually done more research than any other guest we've ever had on this podcast.
I don't have a lot else going on, guys.
So Alice, can I ask you, would you want to see the end of, say, Snap, Crackle and Pop?
How am I supposed to follow that after all that research? I mean, really, if you're asking me Snap,
as
Crackle
consumer,
and Pop,
yeah.
and we've just had some scientific evidence on sugar. No, I wouldn't. My mum had Snap, Crackle and Pop when she was a kid, and I had it, you know, as a treat. I think the thing is, as Jason said, it comes down to the parents. Like, really, if you walk down a cereal aisle, there is so much to look at. Brands want to jump out, and if they're targeting kids, they're going to use things that kids are going to look at. It's up to the parent that's pushing the trolley to say, no, we bought a bottle of box of Cocoa Pops last month and you've had it, you know, you've had your treat. I think it's up to them.
And how about things like Happy Meals? Do you get, you know, as a parent, are you happy to go and get a Happy Meal, for instance?
I do, because it's a lazy option. You know, it's kind of one of those last resorts is what I find. I mean, my issue with the Cancer Council and sugar is there are a lot of other targets to pick on. You've got soft drinks sponsoring extreme sports, chocolate bars marketed as treats to have every day, the sugar content of so-called healthy cereals and the fat content, you know, muesli, etc., and muesli bars. So, you know, I'd love to know how many boxes of cereal are sold in the country and what the top 10 packages are, because I'm sure, you know, the Wiggles are on the side of Weet-Bix. You know, should we be banning that? It's I think it comes down to the parents. You know, how often you give your kids a Happy Meal or an apple is kind of in your hands. So, you know, my daughter knows that she's 3.5. Between 2 and 3, she realised that the Golden Arches meant hot chips. So they're, you know, the Macca's marketers are doing their job, and you know, she also knows the symbol for a toilet, and, you know, I mean, it's iconic imagery, you know, and that is what Macca's means. It's that connection of, like, can you have it all the time? No, like Cocoa Pops, it's a treat.
Mm. Yeah, you know, indeed, that word treat is very important, because Kellogg's, their PR person was very careful to point out that Fruit Loops and Cocoa Pops are marketed as treats now, and the Cocoa Monkey actually hasn't appeared on TV since 2005. So very aware of how they categorise that sort of food. Next, the latest in the world of radio.
So Tuesday saw the latest set of radio ratings. Some notable mentions. The lead changed hands in Adelaide. DMG's 5AA handed over the lead to ARN's Mix 102.3. That's in the Monday to Friday, and also in the drive ratings as well. Still in Adelaide, Southern Cross Stereo's Triple M fell 2% in the Monday to Friday share and 3.1% in morning share. I talked to Guy Dobson, the chief executive there, and he certainly flagged up Adelaide as something that the network and the company is going to be focused on. Mind you, for Triple M in Melbourne, much better, up about 1.6% Monday to Friday. And a very good result for Triple M's grill team, again, the breakfast team in Sydney as well. So happy enough with that, particularly with new personnel on board. Melbourne 3AW increasing its lead. Fox FM and ABC 774 both had drops of just above 1%. And in Sydney, it's always that awkward thing, isn't it? As soon as you announce that a breakfast presenter is going, and in this case, yeah, Merrick had done this 10 years and it was the Merrick and Dools show, then inevitably they have a ratings jump, and that was after another jump as well. So they actually, for their final ratings before they said goodbye, were up about 0.4%. Jason, we talked briefly about that you'd spent some time with over in Brisbane. Have you spent enough time around radio to actually get nervous about when the ratings are coming in? And does it kind of affect your day on the day the ratings come out?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was quite blessed in Brisbane. Nova had launched there and I joined that team and broadcast there. I lived in Brisbane for 8 months, came back to Sydney and continued to broadcast there. And then my boss from Brisbane came to Sydney and took over there, and I broadcast on the Sydney Nova and then nationally on Nova. And it can mean the difference between the champagne or, you know, 5 hours of meetings where they cross-examine every single, you know, break that's gone to air. And my frustration is knowing that the way that these results are gleaned is about as accurate as, you know, the daily horoscopes. Basically, my understanding is 4,000 survey diaries are distributed in a given area. People are asked to log their listening in 15-minute increments over a five-week period. Back in 1972, this was probably a good methodology when people didn't have Facebook and the internet and, you know, a million things to do, and they went, what was I listening to last night? These days, people go, shit, that thing's due. It's like the census. How many people live here too? Da, da, da. So they all tick it off. So it's that top of mind thing. What was the last billboard I saw? Who are Kyle and Jackie O on? Hamish and Andy. And so I think that Merrick thing feeds into that awareness that, well, last show, Merrick, Nova, yeah, I listened to them. So the accuracy, I think, is the worst thing, that people's careers live and die by these figures that are quite hocus pocus.
Yeah, and I guess the difficulty is coming up with a better measure, isn't it? I mean, I remember when I was writing about media in the UK, they were trialling, you know, watches that would record, and they do different things. You know, one would be, it would record like a few seconds, or it would record a second every minute, and then it would kind of try and compare back to, you know, databases, wow, what had gone out,
and a Shazam
wristwatch. Well, exactly, yeah. But the problem was, of course, it was hard to tell whether someone was actually wearing it, or if it was, you know, you left the TV, the radio on overnight, and put the watch by the side of the desk and gone. So I don't think they've managed to come up with anything much better yet, and that's almost the problem. Is they kind of know it's imperfect, but they're struggling to think of a better plan.
Yeah, I don't know that if there is a better way, you know, what the technology, you know, would reveal. And that drop in Adelaide is kind of interesting, just in terms of their football teams have done really badly this year. So, you know, for a breakfast show and a station built around footy, as soon as your footy team's not doing that well, hasn't made it to finals, then I wonder if that, you know, contributes to running out of steam. That is, if you can, you know, use
the results.
That's
a good point. Now, Alice, you wrote the Adelaide story this time around, and Adelaide-cider?
Adelaidean.
Yes, is that
thanks.
What it is?
Adelaidean.
Nice.
Yeah, interesting change with 5AA. KG and Cornsey, when I was in Adelaide, were massive there and always did the footy, you know. Adelaide is a very AFL-centric city, but you're right, Jabra, I didn't actually think of the correlation between the Crows and Port doing badly to that station dropping back, but that makes complete sense.
It's always the same with newspaper sales as well, isn't it? You know, when there's big news going on with a club, you know, stick them on the front page. I remember it came up with Bruce Guthrie when he was suing News Limited, and there were lots of debates about, okay, well, you know, does a sport front page sell more editions? And there was I think there was even criticism of him for not putting them on the cover enough, and there are all sorts of debates about sort of what went on behind the scenes with that as well.
Yeah. That new show, back to Nova, Fitchie and Whipper, so they're new to Nova and Sydney. Just wonder what, have you listened to them yet, Chad? I just wonder what your thoughts were.
I am a big fan of those guys, to be honest. I think their chemistry is amazing with each other. I think they have a genuine, like Hamish and Andy, and I think Whipper comes from that kind of inner sanctum of mates with Hamish and Andy, and you can hear his similarities with Hamish. But those guys are really connected well, and listening to them is a real pleasure. You know, as a guy, I love the fact that Nova kills me to listen to, because I hate the music. I hate the music. But sucked in, I'm 38, I'm still in your demo. Yes, I'm under 40. So I the only reason I would listen would be for American Duels or Fitzy and Whipper. And Whipper, I find, he's a bit like a Dave Hughes. My wife always says she can just watch Dave Hughes. He doesn't have to say anything. She just feels better. She laughs looking at the gap in his teeth or his face or his ears or, you know, like, sorry, Dave. But he's a funny guy to look at. And Whipper's exactly the same. You kind of want to cuddle him, and I hang on his every word. And I just watched a fantastic video that they'd done with Pete Murray, where Whipper rang a listener and said he was going to dedicate a song for her, whip a serenade, I think. He started playing the song. It was dreadful. Pete Murray storms in, grabs a guitar and starts playing. And just to watch Whipper is this great joy. So I think those guys need to do some TV. I think they need to see where they're going from there, because the amount of material they need to come up with to sustain their radio show is enormous, but they seem pretty prolific.
Do you think there's room for another Hamish and Andy style, you know, a radio pair going to TV? We saw American Rosso do it and didn't go that well, but Hamish and Andy have kind of found their place. Do you think audiences will respond to, no, you belong on radio?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. I know that in radio, one of the reasons I've come up with difficulties in securing more work is that I'm not part of a duo, and I might also not be seen as a great team player. I do like to do a lot of solo stuff, and those guys are great as a team. I think, yeah, when you have a comedy pairing, David Williams and Matt Lucas are a good example of guys that it's not just the two of them. The way that they dress up and do these different characters means that they're a lot more watchable, whereas sure. if it's just, you know, you and I, for instance, yeah. then we've got to be pretty amazing to sustain half hour or an hour of comedy. Yeah. And yeah. I think Hamish and Andy may be a little bit tired, fits in Whipper, maybe you're right, maybe they are good on radio and those little snippets that you can see online are, you know, sufficient.
Mm. And it's not that long since they were brought together either, is it? You know, they've actually gelled quite quickly.
Brilliantly. And, they're great guys. Fitzy's an amazing guy. Whipper's very funny. And they just have that great Aussie bloke sense of... They're like a beer ad on radio. You know, they're like that VB ad where the ice meets the VB.
Better than American Jules?
I think so. I think, you know, at the end of Merrick's run, he was probably as sick of the hours and the station and the change of management and the change of personnel on the show. And, you know, I think when he and Rosso split up, that was probably the end of his best days.
Well, as you say, I mean, it's just that material thing as well, isn't it? It's not turn up 5 minutes before the show goes out and say something funny in between the songs. It's the preparation, and that must just get so grinding after a while.
Yeah, I mean, I've never done it to the degree that any of those guys have done, and Merrick certainly did an enormous amount of stuff in the last couple of years, you know, like a Bear Grylls kind of challenge, and, you know, was always challenging himself. I think it's attacking in a way that still is fresh rather than... Here we go. I have to do this.
Next, a new player joins Media Group Buying.
You're listening to the Mumbrella Cast. For more on all these stories, visit mumbrella.com.au. So Advideals will next month join Little Birdie in the group buying space for advertising and media. So Advideals has said that it will aim to differentiate itself from its rival in the new space by offering more traditional advertising spots. So Little Birdie, you may well know, has been offering ad space such as hot air balloons, cocktail napkins and the like. So they've now opened up their platform to media buyers. So Tim, what do you make? I've got a sense that you're fairly cynical about group buying for media and advertising. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah.
But, tell me what you think.
Yeah, I mean, I'm cynical about group buying generally.
Right.
Or certainly some of the dreadful offers. You know, it was like one of them this week was doing, you know, those power balance bracelet things. I forget which brand it was, but one of them was offering those this week. And, you know, it's just like the sort of hokum around some of it. But, so Lil Birdie was the first one to sort of say, OK, we're going to take, you know, advertising inventory and do it. Now, I'm not and genuinely, actually, I don't know whether that one's going to work or not. My first question was, if you were, you know, a media owner and you had some inventory, then you'd be quite worried that all that would happen would be someone who's going to buy with you anyway would just wait until the offer came along and, you know, buy up the pages or whatever it was cheap, and then you know, so your revenue would actually be less than it otherwise would be. And to me, that was the main question. So I remember talking to the guys from Little Birdie just before they launched, and actually I thought it was a really interesting idea and a risk worth taking.
Yeah.
Definitely, but whether it will work, I don't know. Yeah. And whether there's room for two of them,
right?
You know, I know even less. And whether there's room for someone with the dreadful name of Advideals.
Isn't it better than Little Birdie? At least it says what it actually does. And also, what struck me as slightly odd is that now Little Birdie has chosen to open up their offer to media buyers. I would have thought they would have done that to begin with. Any thoughts on why they've done that now?
I think the initial reason was, I think, to give some reassurance to, you know, to media owners that
the media agencies aren't going to just sweep in, buy it for their clients, and then, hey, you know, you're definitely not going to get the revenue. I presume that perhaps the model maybe hasn't worked as well as they thought. You know, I suspect it's not purely, you know, people always say public demand in these things, don't they? You know, my guess is they're having to try out a slightly different model. Nothing wrong with that. You change your model, you try something if the first one doesn't completely work. But yeah, I suspect it was more than just public demand, though.
Right, yes. Advideals, they're talking to me about their launch. They said that this their platform's very much about bringing advertisers, or small companies that haven't advertised before, into media and advertising. So I quite like that model. Alice, Jason, any thoughts on group buying sites?
It's all great to me, to be honest. I find that concept of people spending money to sponsor a napkin or a paper cup for a coffee or any of that kind of stuff intriguing. You know, these new ways to intrude on our lives. I just put down here in my preparation that I really like bus ads. I find them my favourite types of ads. So if there's a
APN Outdoor and Move Outdoor will thank you, I'm sure.
They're amazing. You know, the way that they're so visual for TV shows, for Foxtel and for movies, and they seem to have more bang for your buck. Like, there's still Transformers buses going around. So I think it's when you can enhance the environment and make things more arty. It's like graffiti. I love good street art. I hate tags. So I think advertising is like that. If you can find a way to reach people that puts a smile on their face rather than create more rubbish, then you're doing a good job.
And it's funny you mentioned bus ads as well. APN did this big piece of research where they took all the journos, because for some reason all the media journos, or most of them seem to be based in Sydney, they took them all to Federation Square in Melbourne and unveiled this research that they'd done these kind of brain scans to show that the brain is more engaged when it sees a moving bus ad versus just a still bus ad,
I'm a magpie. When I see something moving, I'm like, yeah. I stop it. Like, if something was moving in this studio, I couldn't concentrate on anything that's being said. I'd be like Game of Thrones.
I can't help but hate bus ads just because they mean that a bus is coming towards me when I'm on my bike and trying to knock me off.
Yeah.
So the very last thing you'd see was a giant Transformer bus looming on you.
Exactly. Yes.
What a way to go.
So, Alice, any thoughts on back to group buying?
Yeah, look, I've used a couple of...
Have you gone on the Tuesday night cheap pizza or...?
No, but I've done a few... It's good for new restaurants, I've found. Like, restaurants that are just opening, need to get some people in the door. I've done about 3 or 4 of them, and I'm lucky enough I haven't been burnt, but I've heard of people who haven't been able to redeem the vouchers or whatever, or it's expired or can't get in and whatever. But my personal experience of group buying has actually been quite positive.
Yeah, I mean, generally, guys, they're here to stay, aren't they? Like, some internet phenomena that come and go, this is not a fad?
Yeah, I'd argue that probably they are. There's probably always people who've got too much stock, want to get rid of it. Yeah. The little bits of research that suggest that actually, once as a brand, once you've done this offer, you struggle to keep the premium image. You know, that sort of is building up. You know, this question of, once you've seen, you know, this underwear at a 30% discount or whatever, are you ever going to go back into Myer or David Jones and pay full price? Or will you just wait for the next offer? Mm. But, you know, that said, got some very good, some good red wine actually through it. Thought it would be dreadful, but actually very good stuff, so it works.
Couldn't the same be argued about any type of discounting though? Like, yes. Myer's putting a sale on, you know?
Yeah, but some brands don't do discounting for that reason, because they want to keep the premium.
Yeah, you
know? Like Apple.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Mm. Indeed. So next, At Home with Julia.
There's more to radio than music for your headphones. Radio can connect your brand with consumers in more ways than just over the airwaves. Check out the case study for Nissan Micro Citizen, where listeners were sent to LA, Barcelona and New York to get in sync with the city. Or the interview on how the Lady Gaga deal for Vodafone All-Time Prepaid was done. See that and more at seeradiodifferently.com.
The ABC launched political satire At Home with Julia last week, based on the life of Prime Minister Julia Gillard. The first episode pulled in just over 1 million, while this week's fell off somewhat, received 889,000. That's a Metro audience. Also, other things going on in TV. Well, the same story again this week for The X Factor on 7, storming away with weeknight episodes kind of ranking up in the top one, the top two. And I guess one of the other kind of interesting things for the ratings this week, Monday morning we saw Sam Stosur beat Serena Williams in the US Open, which was a good morning ratings pool for 9. Usually Sunrise tends to win on from 7, but actually the tennis brought in more than 500,000, about 508,000, so beat Sunrise by a good 100,000. And then a couple of other things going on. The evening of September the 11th, we saw News and Current Affairs dominate with all of the coverage over that anniversary. But also some Australian-made programming as well. So Underbelly for 9, Wild Boys for 7, both doing very well as well. So quite a mixed bag, really. You know, some good stuff rating well in news, some good drama stuff rating, and some sport as well. Jason, what are your TV habits at the moment?
I watch a fair bit of TV. I watch a fair few movies. My favourite thing to watch is DVDs because I have a bit of an insatiable appetite. I'll watch 3 episodes back to back. So watch The Wire.
Just finished The Wire.
See, it's...
So who can do the best Clayton Davis impression then?
That's not very good. That was Tim's.
We'll have to try and see if we can pull in a real one, steal it from YouTube or something. If so, we'll drop it in about this point.
This has completely got nothing to do with anything, but he popped up as a character in Heat, I think.
We swapped a couple of texts on this, yeah. Yeah, sort of points where the character's pointed up as minor supports, yeah.
Very minor supports. Look, that's irrelevant.
But The Wire, good box set, strongly recommend.
Exactly, watch with subtitles. That's kind of where I live, you know, The Sopranos, The Wire, The Shield, any kind of gritty crime cop drama, I love.
Jason, have you seen that yet?
Say again?
Breaking Bad.
No. I've seen it advertised on buses.
Yeah, same here. I saw it on the side of a bus yesterday.
But I haven't watched that yet. I hear it's fantastic. That's the great thing, I suppose, is that you hear about shows and you can kind of file them away to get on DVD.
What about Game of Thrones? Because that's just come to HBO, hasn't it? Or what do they call it here? Showcase, Showtime. Have you had a chance to look at that yet?
We have just watched 3 episodes back-to-back this week. We watched 1 episode and went, gee, that's pretty intense. I bought the book and found it very heavy going, trying to get around the language. And then we watch 3 episodes back to back because I think any of these HBO kind of shows, Mad Men obviously on AMC from the States, they're so rich and so compelling that you can't just stop at 1 episode. And that's where I think the free-to-air viewing is kind of flawed, because Underbelly or Wild Boys, the ad breaks kill me. You know, with MasterChef, which was the big TV show I watched this year and loved it and taped it every night and recorded it, put it through my IQ. I got very good at fast-forwarding at 30 times speed, just going, that's 2 ads, 4 ads, 6 ads, 8 ads, there's a paper towel, it's Matt Preston, and we're back. And because they always have a recap at the start of each new segment, doesn't matter if you tune into the programming. So I find TV is very frustrating to watch unless it's on DVD, unless I can control it. And the same that if I can't find it at JB or at iTunes, I can find it elsewhere and I can watch it when I want. And I find a lot of the programming styles, like with X Factor, I watched one segment of it and they did this. I mean, this is the essential reality TV thing of going, Alice, you came to us last year, you had so much promise, you're back this year and that didn't reach the bar. And everyone's like, oh, but I've decided to give you another chance. And the crowd gets to their feet and you're like, oh, geez, that's 8 minutes of my life I'll never get back where they could have gone. Alice, it was pretty shit, not as good as last year, but you're through. So I can't watch that kind of stuff. Sam Stosur, I think, was great. There's obviously so much male-dominated, you know, footy sport at the moment with finals and with the Rugby World Cup, so that's a great Aussie thing done well. Julia I didn't watch because I'm so over her as a prime minister.
I saw the first episode, not a massive fan, I've got to say. There was, you know, 2 or 3 jokes, but pretty stretched out.
I feel for them. It's, you know, it's great to see stuff produced locally. Anything with Sean McAuliffe is brilliant.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, what local stuff do you like?
I love your general edition to be on Gen X, but unfortunately Charlie Pickering is 1,000 times funnier than I'll ever be. He's great on 7pm. He's someone that's got a great serious side and a funny side. I find that really admirable and a real role model kind of thing. You know, he's written a book about his dad and his dad's best mate. That's hilarious. Sean McAuliffe is brilliant. Like, he is so... I think he's the greatest talent in this country. You know, he and Andrew Denton, I'd like to see them go in some type of tag team battle because Andrew is so bright. Sean is so warped. He's so smart and so just so warped and so quick.
Robin, 9/11. Did you watch much of the coverage?
Not that much. Not much on TV. I read a lot in the newspapers. There are three things, really. I mean, the tales of firemen that lived through the 9/11, I thought that's quite compelling. As were, you know, the sort of stories of human interest stories about where were you when the plane struck the Twin Towers. Fair enough. Wasn't so much coverage, which personally I found most interesting, about what it's like to be a Muslim in Australia or the US after 9/11. I didn't see much of that. I want to see more of it because personally I thought that was really interesting.
I saw one on the 7pm project. They had a series of, you know, Carrie Bickmore had gone to New York and they had an episode every week, every day. And the last one, I think, was actually on a Muslim man who died in the World Trade Center. But they had kept his body because they thought that he was one of the terrorists for months and months and months and didn't release it because they thought he was guilty. And turns out he was working at the cafe or something on the top floor or something. But you're right, that was the only coverage I saw as well. And that was probably the most kind of slap in the face. Oh, my God, let's think about the other side of it here.
I tell you, the really powerful piece I saw was... It actually first aired a few years back, but Nine replayed it on the night. Was there were two French brothers were making a documentary about just following a rookie, sort of you know, fire recruit on his, and they'd been following him for weeks, waiting for his first fire because it was going to be about his first fire, and just going to, you know, false alarm after false alarm, and they were the. You know, there's only one shot of the first plane hitting the building, and it was them who got it. They were just sort of filming him pulling up a manhole cover or something, and, you know, they kind of looked up to the roar of it. So they you know, the first sort of 20 minutes or so, maybe half an hour, is just following in the lives of these guys. So the thing is, and they then followed them into the tower, and they were with them in the tower. And you've just got this amazing thing where you already know the guys before they go into the tower. And then you've got them running for their lives, and then gradually the guys coming back to the firehouse afterwards, and they start to realise that most of them are going to make it back, and then there's just one who hasn't got back, and actually he gets back as well. In the end, almost the last two to get together with the two brothers, but incredibly powerful piece of real filmmaking where, you know, what are the odds that you happen to be making a documentary about those guys on that day?
Yeah. They 60 Minutes interviewed those doco makers actually.
And what
the
are they
week
doing
prior.
Now? What are they doing now? Did they sort of say what they've done now or
no,
since?
I can't recall. I remember seeing it, and I actually watched the show they showed on September 11 or on the Monday. They showed it on 9 to its full entirety, the whole documentary, which I agree was pretty massive. But I don't know what they're doing now. No.
And just, this is jumping around on topics a bit. You saw At Home with Julia?
Yeah, I watched a bit of it, and I also wrote the rating story following it last week. Pretty mixed reviews, skewing the negative end on Twitter, certainly about lots of people comparing it to what the US and UK do with political satire and just how far behind the eight ball we were here.
Aren't they big numbers for a show that to be panned?
Sure.
To have that many people tune in?
Well, yeah, it got just over 1 million. And for the ABC, you know, anything above 1 million is pretty good. On Wednesday night, you know, The Gruen Transfer got second most watched show, and I think that was around the 1.3 mark. So definitely that they're good numbers, but I wonder if it was more of a curiosity thing than a popularity thing. Certainly it's reflected perhaps this week with the numbers down.
Is your experience that people will generally give negative feedback? Like, the people that are going to give feedback are the ones that want to give negative feedback? It's people wouldn't leap to the show's defence or wouldn't run to a blog to say, hey, that show was really good?
Yeah. yes, maybe to a degree. There was still positive comments on Twitter. Okay. People were still backing it. Some people were saying it's great. It's, you know, good timing and everything like that, considering what she's going through at the moment. There were some positive comments, but from the kind of summary that I'd got from a few different sources and had a look at myself, they were...
It's funny, isn't it? I mean, I can think of far more examples of Twitter where people have started violently agreeing with each other that the show is terrible than that it's great. I mean, almost the only one I can think, that was an amazing Twitter response, was the first episode of Angry Boys, Chris Lilley. Twitter loved it.
Wow, hated it.
Well, that's the thing, and it fell away, didn't it?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It was, you know, and the audience fell away as well. But you know, if you read just the Twitter response on the first one, and probably it said something about the Twitter demographic as well, you'd have thought this is the biggest smash hit ever.
Yeah,
I would have thought, go back to where you came from, the SBS show. I think that show, well, since I've been in Australia for 6 months, is the one that I found on Twitter was the most agreed with. I don't know what you guys think.
Sure, and I guess. And it's a different kind of show too, isn't it? I mean, that was like a documentary style wake up call, I guess, maybe to what was going on. This is poking fun at someone, isn't it? So it's all, I guess, it's to a degree about comedy, you know, tasting comedy. Whereas that, everyone was, you know, majority of people were just taken aback by.
Everyone seemed to think there was a necessary show
needed
to be broadcast that is important for Australia, I guess. Mm.
Well, that is all that we've got time for today. A big thank you to Jason Jabber Davis.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
And to Alice Terlikovsky, our producer.
Thanks, guys.
And to Robin Hicks.
Cheers, Tim.
The Mumbrella Cast was recorded in the studios of CBS Interactive. See you next week. Toodle pip.